Do you think your album's going to be a big success tonight?
I think it's going to be, yeah, totally.
Why can't you remember some of the words tonight?
I'm too pissed up, but I'm not even rehearsing anything, and I think it's the top album. And all right, yeah, top can.
How do you feel about being nominated for so many awards and then run away with all of
it? Don't feel anything. No.
Why not?
Because I don't.
No. It's all
normal. Yeah, they played the new stuff, but I can't remember the words.
Yeah.
So the old stuff.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
What do you think of, like, sort of awards seminars?
Well, it's the first one I've been to. Like, I'm asked about them, really. I'm just down here today and I'm doing it. Getting a free drink, it's sweet.
But do you think, you know, like the Brit Awards and like the MTV Awards, do you think do you think this is sort of the same kind of self-congratulating, like, happening? Is that?
I don't know, because I've never been to the Brit Awards. I've never been to any awards, it's my first one.
Did you actually take this nomination serious, or is it just a whole joke for you?
Serious. So I was bored in Manchester, so I thought I'd come down here for a bit of a drink and, like, lose it and do whatever happens.
Radio.
This is history. This is history. Right here, right now. This is history.
Hello.
Hello.
Say your own name today.
Okay. Different. This is Ruth Angel Edwards.
And Adam Gallagher.
And this is Welfare to Artwork.
A series we started in 2020 when we, two artists living in the UK, were both claiming benefits during a very mad and unexpected period when there were suddenly higher numbers of people on benefits than there had been for decades.
So we decided, what better way to spend our time stuck in the house with nothing to do than make a show about artists on benefits.
Indefinitely, and residencies cancelled. I had to give up a studio and then find a new one twice, and then we had to all compete all at once for the same gracious Arts Council emergency grant. Also, FYI, that money
should not be treated as taxable income. Anyway, long story short, Welfare to Artwork has grown into an ongoing series of investigations into the role of the benefit system in Britain's music, arts and subcultural histories. This is episode 5 and we're up in Sheffield broadcasting with Montez Radio.
In episode 4, we got caught up unpacking Britpop come YBA ideology, critiquing the Paul Britannia moment, then looking sideways at how jungle music and black music more generally disrupted the inclusive idea of the One Nation. Looking as well at pirate radio and how music genres were eventually taken up by record companies.
In this episode, we're still making our way through the 90s, and we'll be looking more closely at what happens to the Doll in the transition between the end of Thatcher
and the beginning of Tory Blair, the passing of the baton, as it were.
It may seem like we're going over some of the same stuff in this one, but the last episode had yielded some really good responses and prompted some further reading, so we felt like there was room for us to dig a bit deeper before we move on to the current millennium. This episode will run slightly shorter, and we'll then be chatting live on air to Montez Radio's Emily Pope.
Where do you think we should start?
So we're in Yorkshire at the moment, so what about...
Truth is, I thought it mattered. I thought that music mattered. But does it bollocks? Not compared to how people matter.
When I first heard it, I couldn't stand. But then a second time I thought, actually, this is okay. And third time I thought, this is fantastic. And it's a definite number one, is one called...
We were aware from the very start that our solidly northern sensibilities didn't match what we saw as Crass's post-hippie, middle-class fondness for herbal tea and Eastern philosophies. I reckon we could have sold ourselves as a northern Crass, apart from our inconsistency, love of football, ignorance, drunkenness, class politics, sense of our own ridiculousness, ability to throw a good party, lack of restraint, contradictions, northern accents.
You know, doing stuff like for anarchist groups. When the miners' strike came along in '84, that was a sort of a massive shift in people's politics, because up until that point we'd sort of, I think we'd regarded ourselves as anarcho-pacifists, and so a lot of the causes that we were involved in were to do with animal rights and stuff like that. When the miners' strike came along, that was sort of like this idea that that was a class issue and it was a class struggle, and we shifted, our politics shifted, but also the sort of benefit gigs that we did started to shift, and we widened our horizons, and so we found that meant that we stopped being so isolated in our anarchist politics and started to get involved with working with other left-wing groups and organisations, and with people whose politics weren't maybe exactly the same as our own, but that we had enough in common with that we realised that there was some sort of common ground, and that was sufficient for us to work together. You know, in Britain in the late 80s, there was all the stuff around the poll tax. We did a lot of gigs around raising money for protesting against that, you know, fighting a bill, an abortion bill, or a bill that was Clause 28, Clause 29, which was basically an anti-LGBTQ bill. They're sort of rearing its head again nowadays, I suppose. Both those sort of things are. And then we were just like, we'd be touring a lot, and then, you know, there'd be like, I mean, like, things would come along. Our you know, we got involved, like, in the early 90s a lot in LGBTQ issues, because that's what people in the band were just like, it was part of their everyday existence. And so it just became a natural progression that we were then, you know, putting out singles that were, you know, like, we did a single called Homophobia in the 90s with these Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. There were this gay nun organisation. So there was stuff like that. You know, when Tub Thumping happened, we were sort of, we'd done a massive benefit for the dock workers. It only felt natural that we carried that on into a bigger platform.
I get knocked down.
You had singing anarchists on your show.
Oh, I did. Where did you find them? On the Jerry Springer show?
Chumbawamba!
Will you please welcome, with the anthem, Tub Thumping, the mighty Chumbawamba!
At MTV News Brief, the Virgin Megastore chain has pulled Chumbawamba's million-selling album Tub Thumper from shelves in wake of singer Alice Nutter's appearance.
I think it's okay if you don't have enough to steal what you need.
All proceeds of these TV and movie sales go to activist groups approved by Chumbawamba.
You're assuming that everybody's got an equal chance and that the rules are fair, and the rules aren't fair.
New Labour sold out the Dockers, just like the sellout the rest of us.
Not bad for a group of self-proclaimed anarchists from the UK.
So enough of the ridiculous, I've amazed anybody
take some of it all seriously.
You know, it's just awful, half-sampled, jumpy, shouty tragedy.
They're a collection of ludicrous, elderly anarchist bores who've been banging on since shortly after the Peasants' Revolt about how if only everybody would listen to what they were saying and buy their records, then we would bring down the global capitalist system.
Bands like Chumbawamba and that are a bit daft, really.
In a way, much like I despise Chumbawamba, I despise them for their music. And not
you despise them for their music?
Terrible band.
This is sort of after Tub Thumping. We got offered a load of, we used to get offered, you know, stupid amounts of money for people to use the song in an advert. And so General Motors wanted to use the song in an advert for a Pontiac car. And we turned down loads of stuff. You know, we turned down money from Nike. We turned down money from General Electric. So we were making those sort of decisions all the time. But then this one came along and we just thought, look, why don't we take the money for the advert and then just give the money away? And so what we did is we found Indie Media and Corp Watch. Corp Watch were this organisation who monitored the bad working practices of companies like General Motors. And then so what happened on the back of that was then we then turned that into a newsworthy article, and so garnered press from the fact that we'd even done that, you know, like as though it was like some, you know, that it was some sort of clever situationist prank that we'd sort of turned that idea on its head, that we'd got money for an advert and then given the money away to criticise the thing that we were advertising. So we liked, you know, that. We liked that idea. We got money for, I can't remember what it was. It might have been martini or something. I don't know. It was some drink or something. Anyway, we gave the money from that away to like a anarchist Italian radio station or something like that. So we were always finding opportunities to, you know, use our position to further, you know, causes that we believed in.
Chumbawamba wrecked their purity in order to become a funnel to siphon corporate money into anti-corporate activities. Ultimately, selling the rights of their songs to be used in advertisements had few real repercussions other than angering their fans and diluting their brand. Chumbawamba effectively took advantage of the all-assimilating nature of corporate greed. Chumbawamba had agitated in such a way that made their enemies want to invest in them. Subsequently, the activist accepted Chumbawamba's money with a cowardly air of entitlement, the same entitlement that a previous generation of anarchists had when they accepted public welfare.
Ferrers, Bailey, Ferrell, Hebrides, Malin, Rockall, Shannon, Seoul, Trafalgar, Finisterre, Irish Sea, Biscay, Humber, Portland.
Chumbawamba had agitated in such a way that made their enemies want to invest in them. Subsequently, the activist accepted Chumbawamba's money with a cowardly air of entitlement, the same entitlement that a previous generation of anarchists had when they accepted public welfare.
In sum, then, politics meant, on the one hand, a concern for some other subject for some other time, or which, where it lost third world peoples, or of something highly personal which, where it didn't mean sectarian tribalism, could be easily recuperated into careerism, ethical lifestyleism, radical feminism, gay liberation, animal liberationism. What united the two extremes of other and the individuated personal was not solidarity, but the sense of freedom of moral choice. Politics was no longer seen to be born of necessity.
Rebel all borders! Draw the curtains tighter! Where's the crew?
Each individual is free to choose their own issue. Even though what is in is a matter of fashion, determined by the most in people. Just as everyone is entitled to their own unique individual ideas and opinions, even though they are usually as unthought out and regurgitated as everyone else's. The moral rationale means that the struggle over the doll appears as just one more of these choices, even for those who are on the doll themselves. With so much to choose from, activists are drawn to the most exciting and glamorous actions. A long-term campaign involving months of leafleting outside a job centre in the rain and other such mundane activities does not feature high on the agenda. Lifestylism is the practice of wrapping yourself in a blinkered, self-perfecting, ideologically sound cocoon. The captain of the good ship Lifestyle rarely leaves his bedroom. He makes pronouncements on how other people should live, but doesn't keep his own rules. His idea of politics is not to fight the power, but to fight the imagined enemies on his own side. Tub Thumper liner notes, 1997.
What is most striking is the lack of a real movement to defend the very conditions that make their lifestyles and movements of resistance possible in the first place. The prevailing attitude among individual activists has been that they, personally, will find some way to survive and continue their particular struggles. Thus, a relatively successful and certainly very active political culture, which largely depends for its very existence on the dole, is basically content to pursue particular autonomous projects rather than find an effective unity through defending the very conditions of subsistence that allow their campaigns to exist. Indeed, in this respect, these alternative politicos are no different than the great mass of the unemployed, since in each case, the tactic is almost exclusively to seek individual solutions, scans, signing off, moving away, busking, selling beads at festivals, going to university, etc. As a movement, they think they can simply ignore the threat to benefits through the reimposition of work.
Cool to see the scumba-wamba backlash at last. Mind you, I've always called them arrogant, sloganeering, fucking sellout ride on the bandwagon of gay rights, liberal chanting, shit music, playing good for nothing except laughing at fucking corporate whores. Know what I'm saying? And you can fucking print that too. Just make sure you credit it to me. I'm making my position clear on this. That's Russell from Hull.
Maybe in about 10 years' time, when kids are about 21 that are writing for The Enemy or something and remember tub thumping as something that they jumped around to at school discos, maybe they'll be forgiven then.
At the tail end of John Major's Conservative government, they introduced two pilot schemes named Project Work, which they presented as work experience rather than work for your benefits. The stated aim was to help the long-term unemployed by allowing them to relearn the discipline of work. The schemes began in Hull and Medway, Kent in 1996, and everyone in these areas who had been unemployed for 24 months or more was eligible. The attempts to gloss the workfare nature of the scheme failed, and the schemes never gained legitimacy.
Until
the new Labour government, elected in May 1997, have described the New Deal, or welfare to work, as their flagship policy. And indeed, it characterises in many ways the new Labour approach to work, unemployment and welfare, and indicates why this government has been welcomed so unambiguously by British capital.
Chancellor Gordon Brown has hinted that full employment is a possibility again. The trick is that full employment has become redefined to mean that the opportunities for a life on benefits are going to be squeezed out. In this vision, forms of workfare become opportunity instead of punishment. And with so many opportunities, there'll be no excuse for not having either a job or a training place. Hence the plan to eliminate the dole for certain sections of the population. In effect, and although they certainly wouldn't use the term, workfare has been transformed from anathema to a vital component of the new consensus. The only questions that remain are over the details. In effect, and although they certainly wouldn't use the term, workfare has been transformed from anathema to a vital component of the new consensus. The only questions that remain are over the details.
The project of New Labour began with the recognition among senior Labour Party figures that Keynesian policies were dead, and therefore that socialism, social democracy, was finished. New Labour starts from the assumption that the renegotiation of the post-war settlement begun by Thatcher is irreversible but incomplete.
It is incomplete because the Conservative Party is beset by various irrationalisms. Petty nationalism, racism, sexism, homophobia, which only sustained and aggravated the divisions it provoked in the great Thatcherite upheavals of the 1980s and 90s. New Labour, therefore, wants to eliminate these divisive irrationalisms and create a new consensus on the basis of the existing neoliberal attacks on wages, conditions and welfare. New Labour intends to be the new One Nation party in a country where all agree that flexibility in labour markets is necessary and desirable. Consensus, and hence lack of strife and strikes, make for a more efficient capitalist national machine, as we all pull together for the greater good, recognising our duties just as much as our rights.
Forget the past. No more bosses versus workers. We are on the same side, the same team, and Britain United will win.
In the worldview of New Labour, work is the solution to almost all social ills, providing not just a healthy, competitive economy, but independence and self-respect for those otherwise deprived of the experience of wage labour. The New Deal may be relatively cheap compared to Keynesian strategies, but it must be understood as part of a huge ideological offensive, according to which the work ethic is instilled in everyone, and those groups who have taken a life on benefits for granted come to be included in the world of wage labour. New Labour recognises that a key problem for UK PLC is that too many people are not job ready. Having spent too much time on the dole, they no longer have work discipline and can't even get out of bed on time in the morning. Hence the current talk is of cutting the money paid to unwaged single mothers and those on invalidity benefits, and encouraging them to work outside the home, even part-time. Thus, not just those registered unemployed, but almost everyone is to be expected, if not forced, to work.
As well as that, the whole thing was very white, it was very male, and it was very London-centric. I think it was largely exclusive and the domain of the rich and successful. Beyond that, I think many of us were still struggling on a dole. If you're a woman, then you are completely excluded from most of Cool Britannia, unless you can live up to the loaded image of ladettes. This was not a time for thinking, caring people, and women were excluded mainly from it all. It was a boys' club. If you were of colour, then there were hardly any examples of people in music. At the end of the Cool Britannia period where, if everything was so rosy and wonderful and everybody was benefiting from it, why were there riots in the northern towns of Bradford, Leeds and Oldham? This was Asian people saying, we've had enough and we've been left out. So there was mass exclusion, but the sexy top line of it was drugs, hedonism. Everything's wonderful.
Brilliant, you know, fantastic. Brilliant.
And joining us now to throw a little perspective over the events of the last couple of months, we've got Aki, otherwise known as Propagandi, from Fundamental, and Sonia from Echo Belly. Well, first of all, despite being leading lights in the Asian music scene, you didn't attend the festival, did you?
The Brockwell Park?
Brockwell Park Festival, yeah.
Echo Belly didn't, no.
You didn't know, did you?
No, we tried getting on, but it was like we were told... We try to sort out the bigger bands and things like this, and you know, we said, well, hang on, we've been playing A&L gigs and YRE gigs and fighting racism for the last 2 years ever since Fundamental was kind of put together, and we should be playing, you know.
And there is a school of thought, particularly in the music press, that music's job isn't to do this kind of sort of moral policing and so forth, that it's supposed to be there to provide glamour and fun and entertainment, and that's it, and no thought at all. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Bullshit, really, isn't it? From day one, musicians have talked about politics. You know, love is politics. Everything is politics. I think people just have this misconception of the word, what politics means. And, everyone has done politics. You know, the Doors were talking politics. The Who were talking politics. Everyone. The Beatles were talking politics. Really.
Most exciting bands live are the ones that actually feel passionately about something. Like, I've seen Fundamental video on MTV. It's like... fuck, stupid, it was brilliant. It moves, it's saying something without not being entertaining. It's a double-angled sword because it's got both
you
sides.
Both. Yeah. How quick are you on the uptake for casual racism? For instance, if you were sitting in a bar or something, would you turn around and say something or would you keep quiet?
It depends how many of them there are.
I think I'd urinate on them, actually. I think the time is where, you know, you just can't excuse that type of behaviour anymore. We all know where the BNP headquarters are. You know, that is a place where hatred and, like, you know, people, you know, like, plans are put together to hurt people. And there's no reason for it to be able to, you know, it can exist in this society.
This is something I wanted to talk to you because in a recent interview, Morrissey said that the BNP has an equal platform to speech as any other political party, you know, citing freedom of speech. I mean, do you think the BNP do have a right to freedom of speech, or it's something that we should stop?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think Morris is talking out of his arse, and you know, he's not black, he's white. You know, he isn't getting attacked.
The thing is, I mean, with freedom of speech, I mean, surely the true essence of freedom is to be able to walk down the street without getting your head kicked in.
Totally. I agree.
And that's what these people do. I mean, like, you know, I understand what you're saying, freedom of speech. I believe in freedom of speech for good things, what don't harm people. These people, their freedom of speech means to harm people. Yeah.
Cocaine Orgasm, Tim Allen, Liz Arnold, Bank, Lolly Batty, Simon Bill, John Cousins and Ranu Mukherjee, Stephen Glynn, Gerard Hemsworth, Soren Martinson, Monty and Rosenblum, Chris Ofili, Jeanette Paris, John Stesica, Michael Stubbs, Rebecca Warren, Max Wigram, Andrew Williamson. 24th of the 11th to 24th of the 12th, 1995.
Cocaine Orgasm was our Christmas Jamboree extravaganza. There was no real homogenising factor in the work that the invited artists submitted. We just wanted the gallery stuffed with art. We treated artists' work disrespectfully, but they had to agree to this if they wanted to be in the show. The work was hung against shiny fake ice walls, cardboard, or stood on a gloss black floor with polystyrene snow in drifts against the sculpture and sprinkled over paintings. It was brightly lit, all gleaming and sparkly. On the opening night, Cocaine Orgasm started before visitors even got up to the gallery. The reception area had been done out in preposterous Vegas style by the landlord, with large chrome snake handles on plate glass doors leading into a mirrored atrium. Max Wigram hired paparazzi photographers who were flash gunning away at people as they entered, which made everyone extremely self-conscious. But there was no film in the cameras. Instead, Max had set up a live relay to the gallery upstairs, and when you walked into the gallery, you realised that you must have been seen arriving by the people already up there. It was a great piece of simultaneous voyeurism and narcissism, which with Christmas, the cold, the snow, and the rock and roll title all gave the jam-packed opening a glittery glamour. After the opening, the show had a different feel, however, sort of bleak and mournful. We got the right pitch of airheaded, sparkly fun with Cocaine Orgasm. Excess, drugs and riot glamour, a huge gobsmacking Christmas grotto with art splattered all around it.
Simon. Bank was simply following the tradition of the avant-garde in this, at exactly the time that everyone was busy trying to be market-wise, see Brit art. We were always amazed at how people got annoyed, they did. The two main mags, Breeze and Art Monthly, ignored all our best shows. Not one review, 95 till 98, and I think this was a direct result of saying the unsayable.
Millie. People used to go on about Bank being professionally working class. We weren't actually working class. We were just this clique that would turn up at places and get incredibly drunk and behave really badly. Actually, I think that the London art scene during the late 80s and early 90s was defined by people behaving badly and being drunk. There was always free drink at nearly all private views. We hunted it down. We didn't work hard to be offensive. If we were offensive, it's because we were just being offensive, or we were careless or responsible maybe. And we did offend some people properly, which I regret. That was never the point. It was always the wider art world rather than any individual that we were really interested in. I think Bank sensed the coming era, Freeze Generation and your own art world is bigger Bank below. And though we couldn't know the shape of it, the art world jargon, the increasing professionalisation of it, the YBAs were starting to attract bigger prices and Helen Chadwick that Tony Craig or Richard Wentworth ever did in the 1980s. The stupidity of Cool Britannia was hanging over everyone. There was a feeling that something was going to change, and I think we were making work about that without quite knowing it. And that's why Banks still seems relevant now.
Before the YBA era happened, British art was all upper-class white men and a few white, mainly upper-class women. Even those who hadn't been to posh public schools still came from academic backgrounds. None of the members of Bank had parents who were academics, and we all went to comprehensive schools. We didn't move within those upper-class circles. In the 80s, I remember people started talking about theory and getting very interested in Adorno and people like that. I think at that time, people were beginning to enter the art world who hadn't grown out of this privileged environment because education had begun to open up. I, and in fact everyone I knew, had a full grant to go to college and there were no fees to pay. That was so important because it felt like you could go to college as a person from an impoverished background. Art suddenly had a sense of being a realistic, even vocational course you could take, especially after the YBAs came along. So on the one hand, Bank was commenting on this old-school British privilege, and on the other, we were thinking about how we wanted to be free of theory, in a way. We didn't want to think about Adorno. We wanted to make our own thing. Yeah, I think you could probably split the YBAs into different categories. It's such a spurious term. Because if you think of artists like Abigail Reynolds, for example, she was meant to be a YBA, but you wouldn't really know it from looking at her work. I think the term YBA always had a homogenised edge. I think it was ascribed to a group of people after the event to try and pull them all together. We weren't so conscious of it as a term at the time. When I think about the YBAs, I think about the fact that, although they didn't all embrace the idea of making money, most of them actually ended up making money because of Damien Hirst. He was just so brilliant at that. The other thing about the YBAs that I think defines them, and maybe I just made this up, but I have this idea that a lot of them used other people to help them make their work from the very beginning. The idea of getting somebody else to make your work at the time was still relatively new. Of course, Jeff Koons had done it in America, and there was the idea that you needed to have money to do it.
Looking for you, lost in my emptiness. In the 90s, Not going to lie, it wasn't always fun being Mickey from Lush, inverted commas. I had to develop a hard and mouthy don't give a monkey's shell when on the inside I often felt quite pathetic and vulnerable. Operating in a male-dominated world often felt infuriatingly unfair. Not the individual blokes so much, just the general attitude. And I did my best to toughen up and take it like a man, even act like a man. But as a woman, whatever you do is judged by a different standard. So I'm not moaning about it, I'm just pointing it out. And I'm actually glad I'm a woman, because I'd have made a bloody horrible bloke. Anyway, I've been as honest as I can be, without tipping into self-pity, I hope.
The mainstream is not somewhere I've ever felt comfortable. In the 80s, you had city boys flashing the cash and going, "Way, we're going to take loads of coke and it's fucking great." And we loathed them. We thought they were wankers. Because you were on the outside going, "I don't want to be those people." To me, a lot of Cool Britannia was like, "Great, we're them now." And I thought, why is that something to celebrate?
I'm here. I'm drunk. Had a good night out with my friends. And I'm leaving now. I'm going to be with my friends. I'm going to be with my mum. I'm going to phone her. And she's going to be embarrassed about this conversation. It's live. But I don't care. I think you're a fuck about it. You people aren't relating to me now. You've lost me. Mm. You've lost me completely. There's only one way of life.
Yeah.
This has been Free Cash Presents Welfare to Artwork 5.
As we've said in previous episodes, anyone with any suggestions or who'd like to contribute, please get in touch.
After our last episode, we had a particularly brilliant response from our friend Riyad Akbar. Here's a recorded WhatsApp of him reading his message.
I remember the Enterprise Allowance Scheme. My budding writer friends suggested it to me, but the idea of raising £1,000 or worse, owing someone that amount of money at the age of 17 was alien. And linked to that was a sense that it was a dodgy path to enter. The government introduced it to fiddle the employment stats, and my friends, in their efforts to break into journalism and become writers, were having to masquerade as businessmen entrepreneurs in order to get EAS to pay their rent, food and bills. Both sides were on the fiddle. I was suspicious of this yuppie culture of hucksterdom and scamming that the Tories were promoting just at the time as they were restructuring industries and destroying jobs, leading to mass unemployment. The plan for my friends was to get onto the EAS to tide them over until they could make a proper living out of freelancing or get a job in a newspaper or magazine. But in reality, those sorts of jobs were already part of a vanishing labour market in the newspapers and the media. Trainee or junior reporter roles were few and far between as the 1980s went into the 1990s. Secured jobs advertised in Fleet Street or the BBC, if they took on people with limited experience, were hoovered up by elite university graduates, attracted by Thatcherist culture which abhorred manual labour, and coveted media and advertising professionals where there was big money to be made in these sectors. The huckstering of the EAS days, in fact, was the norm for my friends for decades, working lots of different shitty low-paid jobs, albeit one succeeded in becoming a published novelist and the other a playwright. EAS wasn't so much a stopgap as disciplining people for a certain way of life as a new kind of precarious worker. Angela McRobbie's book, Be Creative, Making a Living in the New Cultural Industries, from 2016, brings up to date the account of the disappearance of secure entry-level jobs in the arts and media. Lower middle-class young graduates doing passionate work, uncomplainingly working into the night, checking any expression of grievance and projecting a professionalised euphoria about work, it's all good, connects back to EAS, the same putting on a mask to perform a part in a Faustian pact. People who have gone on to better things may now remember with fondness their early days starting on the EAS. Yet insofar as they have gone on to better things, they are of course going to retrospectively idealise those beginnings. And in this sense, Angela McRobbie's book does tell that part of the story which they don't mention of capitalist neoliberalism and the arts. Of the monopolisation of job security by the elites, long hours, exploitation of young people on no pay or low pay, limited or no union protection, all risk costs shifted to the young person, sickness, pension. The mastering of disciplines and attitudes to adjust to the unfreedom of the labour process, and the abandonment altogether of the project of demanding improved working conditions in solidarity with other workers.
This has been Free Cash Presents Welfare to Artwork 5.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Montez.
See ya.
Bye.